Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hello and welcome to another episode of I Weigh with Jemina Jamel. I hope you're well, but I also really understand if you're not because everything is so fucked right now around the world. And one of the latest places in which we have seen the attack on reproductive rights is the United States of America, in a place where we thought that it was not possible for Roe v. Wade to be overturned, where we never thought reproductive rights would be gone after as hard as they are now. It's unfathomable. It's almost so shocking that maybe that's how they're getting away with this, because we can't really believe it's real. And I wanted to be able to find you a guest this week who could talk about it with me. But of course, considering what an emergency this is, it is very hard to get hold of advocates for reproductive rights right now. They're all busy fighting for all of our futures. And so instead, I decided to go back into previous episodes and bring back the episode with Elizabeth Banks, because she's an exceptional advocate for reproductive rights and, most importantly, is very knowledgeable specifically about the American system and what we need to do to be able to stop this in its tracks and overturn it. And so I think it's a very honest and open and unjudgmental and empowering episode about reproductive rights and abortion and women's healthcare and the healthcare of all people who have uteruses. And I think that it's also what we need right now is to just be given the information of how to move forward. And so she has organizations that she advocates for and works with, and she has details of how the system works. And so hopefully the feeling of knowing that you have some sort of access to action might be an empowering moment for you. And also, if you are someone who has ever had an abortion or who has ever considered having an abortion, this episode will hopefully make you feel less alone, as I have been very open my whole career about having had one and how much it saved my life. And it was the best decision I've ever made. And obviously not everyone feels that way. Everyone's not as quite celebratory as I probably sound, but it did literally change the course of my life and save my life and allow me the freedom to have all of the recovery I've been able to have in my own life since making that decision. I'm not just talking about like dumb shit like fame or success or money, any of that stuff. I'm talking about the life I live now, how much I have recovered with my mental health, how much my physical health has recovered, how much happier I am as a person, all of which I've been able to do by being able to have autonomy over my own lifeline and be able to be selfish and protect my own sanity and not have to give up everything for another person. That just isn't something that I wanted. It's something I still don't want. It's something I wasn't ready for, and that should never, ever be forced on any human being. We currently live in a world in which you have to give written legal consent for your organs to be used to save the life of another, even after you're dead. So dead people will have more rights than people who are alive who happen to have uteruses. It is so fucked and terrifying. And I hope this episode was something to lift some of that weight and to make you feel like change is possible. Elizabeth Banks believes change is possible. And that is what we need right now, is that attitude, because we still have time to turn this around. We just need to jump into action and start electing people who are in the corner of the freedom and humanity of all people who have uteruses. I send you loads of love, and I hope you enjoy this wonderful episode with Elizabeth Banks. Elizabeth Banks, welcome to I Weigh. How are you?
I'm very well and so happy to be talking to you. I love this podcast. You have such fun guests. I can't believe I'm one of them now.
Oh my God, you're so ridiculous. It's a huge honor to have you here. I'm a massive fan, and I have in recent years years, grown to love you as a human, face to face.
Thanks, lady. I know, we met in 2015?
We met in an audition. That was like how we met. I was auditioning in front of you and I was shitting myself because I think you're one of the truly great comedic actresses of all time. And I had to stand there and be funny in front of you and I was mortified, but you were so nice to me. but yeah, you were a very comforting and decisive leader in that situation. And so I hope one day we get to work together where I can be led by you full time. But yeah, you're a fave of mine, a long time fave. I think the first time I came across you was probably 40-year-old virgin in opposite Steve Carell. And I was like, who the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Because it was a new type of movie, a new genre of film. And they were films that didn't give a lot of funny roles or moments to women. And I feel like you just came in just like, this is it. I'm going to make an impression.
It's hard not to when you get to masturbate in a bathtub on film. So you tend to stay in people's minds after that happens.
Yeah, well, I didn't forget you. And I've really enjoyed following your career ever since. There's so much that you do, not only as an actor, but also as a director and an advocate. There's a million things I want to talk to you about. First of all, how are you?
You know, I'm great. I'm really busy right now. So that's exciting. I feel like there was, I wouldn't say fallow time, but there was definitely a lot of family time, a lot of focus on the family this during the pandemic, and everything seems to be opening up. And I suddenly feel actually slightly overwhelmed at how much I'm about to embark on, which is great. I'm prepping a movie that I'm going to direct. I'm prepping a movie that I'm going to act in. And, you know, being a mom and my son turned 10 yesterday. So
that's the sweet
other thing that's going on. Yeah. We did a birthday Zoom celebration and just, you know, making him feel special. Cause that's what you have to do when you get double digits.
You and I, when I called you for the little kind of like pre-interview chat and we were talking, I was explaining to you about, you know, and you listen to this podcast anyway, thank you very much for doing that. And it's about mental health. And when asking you about your mental health, you were telling me, that you've been very lucky in the fact that you've had a kind of stable upbringing, stable existence. Like you have a fairly stable brain chemistry, and you spoke about that with immense gratitude and almost reticence because it's so rare, I guess. but you did mention that you do, however, struggle with instability around your hormones, around your periods. And I thought that was really interesting and something that I wanted to talk about because that is a different type of struggle that we just don't hear enough about.
Yeah. I mean, look, I feel what I was really getting at was that I feel really grateful in that I think I'm pretty in touch with my body and I'm pretty in touch with what's going on with me. And for sure, I have had periods of time in my life, but I can tell you they're almost always, it was like, you know, adolescence, puberty, when your hormones are going crazy, when everything was awful and I hated everyone. And, you know, I had really dark, dark moments. When you think you can only see what's right in front of you and you cannot see the next day, you cannot see the sun coming up. So I just want to say that, you know, I have a deep sense of empathy for mental health issues because I have recognized them in myself. My mental health is in really good condition, but it's not because, you know, for no reason whatsoever. I'm certainly very aware of like having to care for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes from PMS and PMS being like a real thing that's, you know, premenstrual syndrome.
It's an interesting subject where for a while the concept of PMS was used, it was kind of weaponized against yes. us, and it would be used to kind of gaslight us around certain situations, or, you know, it would be used to diagnose our rage as something other than our right to be upset in a certain yes. situation. And I have participated in that humor before, a lot of people have, but then I feel as though that became so rightfully stigmatized that then we stopped kind of having the conversation around PMS, because we were like, then if we talk about it, then they'll know right. that it's real and they'll start using it against us again. And so then I don't feel as though I ever have the conversation really about PMS beyond just kind of cramps and anything right. that feels more physical. We don't talk about the psychological aspect because we're so afraid of it being weaponized against us, but we fucking need to. And I feel as though almost maybe as my friends are getting older, we're recognizing like more and more severe symptoms
yes
around our periods right. And so I would love to know what your experience is. What do you become like? What's your vibe?
Well, okay, so mine's really specific, and okay. just so ever, you know, full disclosure, I've had a very regular period, mm-hmm. like 24 to 26 days since I got my period when I was 11, just before my 12th birthday. So 3 months before my 12th birthday. So this is a long time that mm-hmm. I've been dealing with this monthly extravaganza in my life. And so, you know, I really luckily, once you get through puberty, when the hormones are all over the place and it's not particularly regular, in my 20s, I was like, oh, okay. 3 days before my period, I have massive insomnia, for instance. And for a long time, I would lay in bed and just be like, oh my God, why can't I sleep? And I would, you know, you do your self-check-in, like, do I have anxiety? Like, what am I worried about? Cause you know, your brain's running constantly when you're most people, when they have insomnia. And I would just say, they're like, I just literally, my body is not interested in sleeping. And then, and through tracking it, which now you can do on apps, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I do. Mine tells me like 5 days before my period, I'm about to become a massive bitch. It gives me a heads up so I can send the alert out.
Exactly. So I had to just sort of like, literally I had a day planner and I would write like day one in my, you know, day planner every time I got my period. And then I could count days and be like, okay, I'm coming up on this period when frankly, I'm getting a flush of hormones and it's changing my body chemistry. I just know that it is. And it's not only that, it's switching something in my brain that makes me for sure way more emotional. For sure.
How emotional? Like
a song makes me cry.
Do you know? Right. Yeah. Yeah.
the Hallmark commercial that you're like, I mean, I can't believe that then he gave her a Mother's Day card, you know? and where it really affects me is I'm like a lit fuse. So I'm just so sharp. My problem solving ability goes to like zero. And I'm just like, I need the problem solved this second. Yeah. I don't understand why things aren't working out today. And it's not a long period of time. I'm talking like 3 to 5 days in my life.
You get the rage? Do you get rage?
But monthly, it's not so much rage. It's a short fuse. It's right. like, it's a lack of coping with when things are not going well. Mm-hmm. And like everything just feels either more anxiety or things that normally wash over me or don't seem like a big deal to me suddenly seem like the biggest deal in the world to me. By the way, I'm not as nice to my kids and I'm not as nice to my husband. Like I see the behavior and having healthy mental health is really about understanding those moments and knowing that this is a chemistry, that something's gone sideways and, you know, and it's real. It's physically happening to yeah. your body and to your mental state, but you know what it is. And now you're going to use better coping mechanisms. You're going to not scream at someone. You're going to recognize like, okay, this is me. This is not that they're not doing anything outside their ordinary behavior, particularly. I'm having a crazier reaction to it. I hate using the word crazy, by the way, but it's the easiest, I think, a simple way to say how you feel.
We're all collectively, you know, easing it out of our vocabularies. But it's, I don't get too many emotional ups and downs necessarily. I definitely become impatient the day before, but mostly I become extraordinarily needy. I become very, very needy. I'm hugely independent and quite cold and not very touchy-feely for a lot of the time because I'm just kind of getting on with shit, getting on with my life. And then suddenly about a week before my period, I'm just like a fucking octopus. I have my arms and legs become tentacles that will just like, like cling to the nearest human to me. And I live with all of these friends of mine and they just have learned to tolerate that, like that when I suddenly become extremely sweet, extremely generous, with my love, they know that it's because I'm having a chemical imbalance in my brain,
yeah,
and that I'm manipulating them into giving me the cuddles that I need that last all day. So I just become this like, it's like something out of a horror movie. But that's it. I become so far quite needy and hugely impatient the day before. But I'm also wondering, after having spoken to you, I have these random patches of insomnia every single month. And I just sit there feeling like a failure, feeling like I'm going to fuck up the next day. And then the next day I have loads of energy. I don't feel as though I haven't slept overnight. And I think it is wild that it's still such a mystery to us that we're not encouraged at school to start tracking our periods, start tracking our symptoms. I wasn't told anything about them. I wasn't told anything about sanitary towels or tampons. I still don't think that we are. I was taught about the doodles of the reproductive system and how babies are made, but I wasn't given any advice. And I can't believe that I'm getting to my mid 30s before I'm finally realizing, you know what? I should write this shit down.
Yeah.
We had Aisling B on this podcast, who is hilarious. And just a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about the fact that that she doesn't think that it's possible that men invented the calendar. She was like, why would men need to know when the next month is coming around? She was like, of course it was a fucking woman. Of course she probably wrote the calendar in period blood with her finger to be able to figure out when this hell was coming back around.
I think what you're bringing up is really important, which is that women throughout history have been tracking for family planning purposes and mental health. I'm sure, you know, the other thing that happens to me, frankly, the positive thing is I get really horny right before my period. Mm-hmm. And I also have the cravings. So I have I make cookie dough pretty much. If I'm in my house and I'm like, gosh, you know what I need to do? I need to make cookie dough. It's literally 5 days later, my period's coming. I don't bake any other time of the month. I bake exactly 5 days before my period's coming. It's because I need cookie dough so badly. Okay. And then I'm super horny and I eat voraciously and I get bloated. And then right afterwards, I'm not hungry at all. I truly lose my appetite for a couple days. I don't really eat. And same thing when I have the insomnia.
Not feeling as horny afterwards?
Not really.
It's funny that, isn't it? I always wonder if that's quite confusing for my partner because I'm quite similar. And so I go from being this sort of like cookie monster, sex monster, cuddle monster, every kind of monster to just being quite aloof and uninterested in food, uninterested in anything, uninterested in a cuddle, just like, and then it kind of slowly comes back again over the course of the month, but it's like dropping off a cliff every single month. Yes. And I can't help it. I like what I like when I like it.
Yeah. I think it's important for women though to hear that, it is a cycle, you know, that there's a chemistry and a hormone situation like going on that you can't really control. I mean, people who are on the pill control it slightly, but I mean, I was on the pill for 10 years and I still had most of the hormonal things I'm talking about still happen to me as your body prepares to have a baby or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that let's also hear that out loud. Your body every month prepares to have a baby.
Yeah.
And then when it doesn't, let's go of that idea. And so there's this physical thing happening inside of every woman from puberty until menopause that if you aren't aware of or are not thinking about, you're having episode, you know, you're having some sort of episodes potentially in your life that you don't understand are just really just part of being a woman. Yeah. And I've loved what you said about it being weaponized, because I mean, I've had, you know, how many times have we heard, you know, women can't be a CEO or be president because my God, they might get emotional for a day of their.
All right, Brett Kavanaugh, like, yeah. What was his fucking excuse?
By the way, as if, you know, what I'm saying is like, I get it. I'm in control. Like, I understand what's happening to me. I make the adjustments in my life and I keep going. This has never kept me from a job. It's never kept me from staying in my happy marriage. It's not kept me from a single thing in my life. And, you know, maybe it makes a moment with someone more tense than I would like it to be. But then take responsibility for that, apologize and move through it.
And you have 27 more balanced days.
Yes, exactly. And the idea that like somehow I'm not as capable on those days is ridiculous, because that's not true. And if anything, I think women prove month after month that anything you can do, we can do. Bleeding, which is my favorite.
Yeah, I love that so much. I've got a kind of I'm reconfiguring my relationship with the term "Are you on your period?" Where I now think of it as just a. It doesn't feel like an insult anymore to me. As in, I'm aware that people try to use it as an insult, but now I look at it as like, oh, are you going through this extremely traumatic thing and you're holding your shit together by getting out of bed today? Well done.
Yes, but that's right.
But I do recognize it as something that can change your mood. And I think that we should make space for that so that the world can make space for this massive change that we're going through. I think it was Riz Ahmed. There was an actor who once told me about the nut mist. He was talking to me about the fact that I can't believe we talk about women being so hormonal when they only go through this big shift maybe once a month. He was like, if men do not, you know, release.
Work it out.
Bust that nut, then they become like, to quote this person, gorillas in the mist. And so that's why he calls it the nut mist. And he's like, this is a 3-day cycle where we could kill someone. Like, we are out of our mind. Like, we have lost all rationale. That's it. We can't, we are having so many sexual thoughts, so many aggressive thoughts, like we're totally out of control. Fucking every 3 or 4 days. Yeah. So why are we acting like women are the only ones who have something that they just need to manage? So I don't know. It's like a thing that I'm trying to normalize in my own head. Are you on your period? As something that doesn't feel like a massive rude insult or a gaslighting statement. Just you got a thing that you need a little bit of support with right now.
Yes, that's exactly it. Like, yeah. I think that's exactly the way to think about it. That it's not, you know, it's not some, oh, she's got a, wow, this lady. You're like, oh, okay. It's an understanding. You know, I was telling this story recently. I was in a fitting and the costume designer and the costumer. So the woman who like helps with all the clothes and clothes, they were in their 50s. And then I was in the room and then a young actress was in the room. And so, at a certain point, the costumer kind of got a little wild-eyed and looked at me and looked at the costume designer and said, like, is it a little hot in here? Do you think we can open a window? And the energy that went between her and me and the 50-year-old costume designer was like, oh, she's having a hot flash. She's having a hormone thing right now. She needs some help, like a little relief. Yeah. She was kind of wide-eyed looking at us and we were like, absolutely. Let's open the window, you know? And a minute later, the very sweet actress who's in her 20s and has no idea what energy just transpired between the older women in the room was like, I don't know. I'm a little cold. Do you think we could close the window? And the panic that flashed on the costumer's face, like, no, please, I need the one. Yeah. And just, you know, so it's important to remember too, like, this doesn't end, you know, there's not like, it carries through for women for a long time in our lives.
Yeah. And
so, you know, the care that needs to be taken in those moments of empathy of like, you know, no one's saying out loud like, oh, she's having a hot flush and going through menopause and needs the window open. It's just like when we all know what's going on, we can help each other through it.
Yeah, we can also help ourselves. Aisling was fascinating in that she was talking about this book called Period Power, which I mentioned to you when we were on the phone by Maisie Hill. And I'm going to try and get Maisie on this podcast to come and explain it further to all of us. But she's written a book that explains exactly what's happening to our brains and to our bodies and how to utilize that for strength, not just like, oh, I'm so delicate now and I just need help. There are some moments during our cycle where we become superhumans, where our brains function so well and it's often the same cyclical pattern. And so if we could just learn when that time is via this journaling that you seem to be doing already, like from when you were younger, this is before we even knew about this practice, then we would be able to utilize that for our strength of like, this is my week to just stay home and chill and like, or be more creative. This is my work to go and get shit done and move house or do all of these difficult things or help family members, etc.
Yeah.
If we start to like play to our strengths and no longer look at them as weaknesses, but just alterations, I think it could completely transform our lives. When is a good time to do a job interview? When is a good time? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When's a good time to go on a date?
Well, when you, like what you were saying about the insomnia and how the next morning, like I have these nights of insomnia and I like, I don't need the sleep. My body is telling me like, you're fine. You're going to be great on 3 hours tomorrow. And you don't believe it until you've done it enough times. So you're like, oh yeah, I don't even feel tired. In fact, I now use those nights to get work done, to like, or like watch a movie I've been waiting to watch. You know, I get the house to myself at 3 o'clock in the morning. Like I don't lay in bed anxiety ridden that I'm going to be exhausted the next morning anymore. Cause I actually know I won't be. My body is not letting me down. It just doesn't need sleep tonight for whatever reason. I don't know. I feel super energized the next day.
This is really helpful. You having told me that on the phone has just made me, it totally fucked my brain. Because I was like, oh my God, this has been happening to me and I've just been torturing myself every month for like 20 something years.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery doing? Are you feeling very charged up and full of life, or are you feeling like me, completely drained and you want to run away? Have you asked yourself how you're feeling? Have you really encouraged yourself to navigate whether you feel like your cup is full? Do you know how much is the right amount of socializing for you? Do you ask yourself what you really want versus what other people expect of you? I do think that therapy is a really interesting tool to help you have that self-awareness and to maybe give you the vocabulary to draw those boundaries. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient. It's super flexible. It's suited to your schedule. You just have to fill out a really brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you don't like them, you can just switch them. And it's super easy. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/iway today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iway.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
You have a huge interest in reproductive rights. You have been one of the more vocal advocates in mainstream media who has been talking about women's rights to reproduction. I'm someone who talks a lot about our freedom to all reproductive care. And I'm someone who's had an abortion, very open about it, very chill about the whole thing, don't have any regrets, wasn't in an emergency, it wasn't a victim of an assault at that time, just did it because I needed to do it, because it was my right to do it, because it was better for my life.
Yeah.
In that time. And that is fine. That is healthcare. And that is something that you feel too. Would you talk to me a little bit about it as someone who's so open about it? Also, do you mind me asking, have you ever participated in an abortion? Had one?
So
participated, you know, in means, have you ever given one? Have you ever had an abortion?
So I have. So first of all, I've never had an abortion.
Right.
But I have absolutely benefited in my life from the knowledge that if I needed to have an abortion, I could have one. Meaning knowing that I had access and a right to it, and gave me a real sense of freedom in my life. You know, it allowed me to frankly have wonderful, loving, intimate relationships in my life. I also always was with a boyfriend who I knew had the same values as me about it, and also didn't want to become a parent before they were ready. And I think, you know, there's also that time I remember I've been married to my college boyfriend now for, I don't know, 17 years or something, 18 years. So I've been in this very long relationship with him, and we started dating when I was 18. And I remember around like 25, 26, like having a dinner with him. We were out to dinner and I was like, hey, so just so you know, I feel like if we accidentally got pregnant, I'd probably at this point, I think I'd have the baby. And he was like, oh, right. Yeah. Okay. And we kind of, because you got to check in on that stuff. Like if he was like, no, I'd still want you to get an abortion, you got to make sure you're on the same page about those things, you know? Mm-hmm. So we had been in a relationship where it was like, if we got accidentally pregnant, I was probably going to have an abortion. And then there's a certain moment you're like, no, actually I'm ready. I would be a parent with you. If it happened with you, in this committed, loving, you know, relationship where we're already talking about our future together, I was ready to parent in that time in my life. And it was really, I think it's, you know, it's just a really important check-in that I still remember being the moment where I was like, oh, okay, I've now changed my stance. I'm ready to, you know, if something were to happen, I'm going to do it. I'm going to jump in, you know?
Yeah.
And before that, so grateful to have had a mom who I would have told about it at the very least, you know, my sisters, like I had people that would drive me and help me, and, you know, I had resources. The Planned Parenthood you could walk to from my high school in my town where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, just knowing that that was there and was a resource for me. That is not the case for millions of women in America and the millions and millions more around the world. And
I got pelted with rosary beads when I went for mine. Just threw rosary beads at me. That was very, very intense. It's fine. Didn't deter me.
Yeah. I think also there's a, you know, I think also when there's so many women who go through infertility, and, you know, it takes a lot of the, what's the word? I don't know, like the holiness or something that people want to put on pregnancy.
Yeah.
Takes the holiness out of it. You're like, oh, it's like a sperm meets an egg, and then it divides cells and they implant in the, you know, I mean, it's a really scientific process, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you intend for that to happen, it's wonderful. And when you don't intend for that to happen, I don't know why it's not okay to be like, that was never the intention.
You know? Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It was your show, Shrill, that I watched where I understood finally how I got pregnant, because obviously I had the sex and the condom broke. And so I did the thing that you're supposed to do. I went a couple of hours later to the pharmacy and I went and got the morning after pill, and then it didn't fucking work.
Right.
And I didn't understand how it didn't work. And I later, 7 years later, watched the show that you'd produced, Shrill, with Eddie Bryant, which is such a good TV show, by the way.
Thank you.
And And she says in it that the pill doesn't work if you're over something like 175 pounds. I was way over 175 pounds when I got pregnant. And the pharmacist definitely knew that when he gave me the pill, but just didn't tell me. Either he didn't know. I did not know that there was a potential weight limit on how impactful the fucking contraceptive pill is for someone. So I just took it thinking I was safe and then boom, I'm pregnant. That is, and even if I hadn't done all that, I still don't have to have a baby. But the point is that fucking hell, if they can't even make the system to protect us from it, like two different man-made things, as in male-made inventions, didn't fucking work. Why do I have to have a baby?
Well,
you never do.
Yeah, I work with the Center for Reproductive Rights. I'm the chair of their creative council very proudly. And they, you know, they really do a lot of the legal work to keep not just abortion legal, but so much work on reproductive health across the board and maternal health and equality, you know, and human rights. I mean, this is the thing. It's like, the world that we're talking about, just to be clear, is the difference between women deciding when and with whom to get pregnant without government intervention or forced pregnancy or criminal prosecution. This is the line that's being drawn, right? When we talk about these things. So there's either is an accessible human right or it's forced pregnancy and, or criminal prosecution. I mean, those are the sides in this.
And so it's more extreme than a lot of people realize. Like they don't understand why we need to like keep our attention on this. And I think for a moment when Amy Coney Barrett was brought into the Supreme Court, we was talking about it again. And then we stopped talking about it again. And we stopped talking about her or all the people who are in the Supreme Court who want to take away these abortion rights. What you don't realize is that you can have a miscarriage and potentially be prosecuted.
That's right.
And if they find exactly anything in your system, maybe you had a bit of, I don't know, like you smoked a tiny bit of weed and you didn't even know you were pregnant and you happened to have a miscarriage that was totally unrelated because that is unlikely to cause a miscarriage. They can say, well, this was found and traced in your blood. You did it on purpose. This was a homemade abortion. We're going to prosecute you for this. You'll be charged.
There are women who have obstetric emergencies, right? So whether it's a miscarriage or some other, you know, their placenta falls apart, like there's different kinds of obstetric emergencies that happen to women all the time in pregnancy. Pregnancy is not some like guaranteed, you know, not thing. It's every body is different, and the things that can happen absolutely result not so much in America in this moment in time, but make no mistake, that's the direction it would head. In South America, they put women in prison who are mothers, by the way, parents, because they have an obstetric emergency, and then they end up in jail for 10 years for a quote abortion that was never an abortion. But the doc, they show up, you know, at the hospital, and the doctors are so afraid of prosecution themselves that they have to call the police, and then the police get brought in, and then, you know, and the whole
because
system
the
is,
doctor who would remove the fetus could then be tried, correct. But they could be then prosecuted for murder.
So yeah. So the point is that there's layers of laws that make it really hard for women to, who, by the way, may have wanted that may have been a wanted baby that they've just lost. So now they're grieving, they're in jail, they have left their families. I mean, it's
makes no fucking sense. It's so outrageous.
It's so misogynist is what it is, I think.
Deeply. I'll never forget that interview that, I mean, obviously we don't know her anymore, but Trump, when he said, he was like, yeah, I think there should be some punishment for the woman. And they were like, and what about the man? Because he's also got a part to play. And he's like, no, I don't think any punishment for the man. It's just, it was just one of the most extraordinary things I think I've ever seen on television. I was like, wow, you're saying that in the noughties on television. Like that's genuinely how you feel. That's extraordinary. And so many people, really, really fucking powerful people agree with you. So how can anyone out there who's maybe just learning about what a potential serious nightmare and how very possible this is to happen in the United States? This could happen. This is not out of the realms of possibility. It wasn't only a matter of decades ago that we first were able to, you know, with Roe v. Wade, make it something that was accessible and safe.
Yeah, I think the important thing to
How do we support sort of, these cause?
Yeah, well, for sure you should support the Center for Reproductive Rights. It's at Repro Rights on all the social meds. But the other thing is, and if you follow me on social media, I post about it, you know, pretty regularly. There are other organizations who are also doing that. But you know, and you can also support Emily's List, which advocates for electing pro-choice female candidates mm-hmm. office at every level of government. So, you know, state government all the way up through the federal government. And I find that just even doing that is enough. It's important to remember, too, that, you know, 1 in 4 women will access abortion in their life. So this isn't some rare thing. The other thing is it's made out like it's super controversial that Roe v. Wade, you know, there's so many people that want to be. It's something like 80% of Americans believe that abortion should remain accessible and legal and mm-hmm. safe. And the other thing to remember is that when abortion becomes illegal, that doesn't mean abortion goes away and mm-hmm. ends. It just drives abortion underground and makes it way less safe for women to access. And also that this is in the time that we're in right now, when I think everybody's trying to do their anti-racism work and their, you know, their understanding about what systemic issues, you know, this is absolutely one of them. Because if you live in certain communities, abortion is going to, you'll be able to find one. And this disproportionately, access to abortion or lack thereof disproportionately affects low-income women, women in marginalized communities across America, in every community.
Yeah.
And so this is also just, it's part of a larger idea is my point. You know,
it's controlled. It's controlled. Gloria Steinem talks about this all the time, that it's like one of the first moves of fascism is to take control of women's reproductive rights and control their bodies as if men have ownership over it. Yeah.
And, you know, women have been sort of taking care of this since there have been women. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there was family planning, always, you know, you had a baby, you had to carry it. You were in a caravan. You made sure you didn't have a baby until that one could walk or somebody else could carry it. You know, the village was always a part of this. And, this isn't new. The other, you know, the other thing there's a whole history to, the abortion rights movement in America, and it's very obviously politically motivated mm-hmm. and you know, doesn't actually reflect a lot of people's understanding about equality and morality.
No, but the minority who believe that we should have those rights are very loud. I'm constantly in their papers. There was a headline last week and they'd written, I can't believe this is legal. You know, when you're just too exhausted to sue, where they'd written, it was a picture of me. I have said in the past that the best decision I've ever made was my abortion. And then I took it back and I said, cutting bangs was the best decision I ever made. And then my abortion. And it really did save my life. And I wasn't trying to be trite or glib about it. I was being very, very honest and sincere. It saved my life at the time in which I did it. I was not mentally stable. I was not ready. Like, it was just all wrong for me. My happiness was at stake. I didn't have what would be needed to give to a child to bring them up safely and or put my body through that. And so I just shouldn't have to. So I talk about it very frankly. And the headline they used was killing my baby. And then they used, in inverted commas, was the best decision I've ever made, says actress Jameela Jamil. They wrote killing my baby as if I'd said that.
Right.
The violent language of that, literally violent language of that, talking about it as if it is already like the way that they try to overly, not humanize, dramatize. But like dramatize and like make it seem like it's a living, sentient, like cherub who's there rather than just cells in the body.
Yeah. Well,
it's just like, it's a whole thing. And I'm not saying it's not cells in the body. All I'm trying to say is that they romanticize it in order to push a birth that they have no setup for supporting you through once that baby comes out the womb. Once that baby is out the womb, there is no support system for you. If you are a single mother, if you are a teenager, if you are a victim of a crime, there's no guarantee of any fucking support anywhere. You're on your own. So
let me be clear. If we wanted to do away with abortion, we would have forced reversible vasectomies for every male when they turn 16, 17, 18. So when they're ready to become a father, they can reverse it and go become a father. That's how you get rid of abortion. Like, there's a whole other side to think about this.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
What has the experience been like being the storyteller now, being the producer of other people's stories or being the director? What has that been like for you? Because I know that I've heard you talk about the fact that you do not consider it just this big feminist statement, and it's often treated just as a feminist statement, whereas actually you're just like, no, I have a perspective and I would like to share it, or I'm interested in helping bring other people's perspectives to light. It's just a part of your humanity.
Well, the difference really is that when you're a woman who, you know, plenty of men have directed or created or made stories about really interesting women with agency. There are a lot of good directors that have done that. You know, David O. Russell comes to mind for some reason, but you know, I was just talking about like Jenna Rollins and these amazing roles that she played back in the day. You know, a woman under the influence, for instance, comes to mind. So there are these stories exist, and men have directed them forever. The fact that women are now taking over the storytelling, for some reason, if I direct a story about a woman, it's this feminist statement because, you know, look at this woman doing this woman thing. And, you know, I don't know. And it's just sort of like, I just wanted to tell this particular story. And if a man directed it, you wouldn't say the guy was a feminist, right? And when have you ever read that? When have you ever read that? Like,
never.
You know, well, Ron Howard is directing Cate Blanchett in a Western, so he is now a feminist. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's he just so told true. A story with a female protagonist. So that's really what I'm talking about. It's a very interesting dynamic and a line to walk because, well, of course I am a feminist. And of course I do connect to this story as a director. And of course I love this character that got created by this actress, but I'm not trying to be political. Do you know what I mean? It is political in its essence because so few women do it, which is a systemic thing. And that's a whole other conversation, but just, it's interesting that the perception is that when you take on some, typically male role, like directing a movie, and you put women in it, and you have women behind the scenes writing scripts or, you know, being, you know, your costume designer and your DP and your department heads, that somehow it's some, you know, giant political, it's presented as a much more political statement than really we're just trying to I don't know.
It feels a bit like underhanded tokenism sometimes, you know, where you get treated like if you tell a minority's big story, you tell a big story about someone with a disability, it's the focus on it is the social politics of it rather than, no, this person has an interesting story and we just don't hear many of these stories because we don't make just nuanced and interesting, complex stories about these types of people. And so I sometimes worry that when they treat every single thing that we do as a feminist political statement, rather than an interesting story that was supposed to be told, it's a bit like, oh, that's why you wanted to tell that story, because it's trendy, or it's, you know, it's centering women.
I do want to say, I think it's also related to the fact that I'm an activist for women a little more openly than other women. Because I think there are women who make films with female protagonists and don't get this, I don't know, don't end up in the press. It's just like, she's made some feminist statement or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And you said that you don't often get asked technical questions, which I thought was really interesting, that men will be asked about what lenses they're using or their cinematography style or how they're progressing as filmmakers. And you don't actually get asked a lot about that sort of stuff. What do you get asked about?
I don't get asked a lot. I mean, one of my favorite horrible questions was I had an interviewer say to me, oh my gosh, you're a mom and you directed this movie and it's so much work and you acted on this television show at the same time. Like, I mean, don't you just want to like take a bath? And I don't know. I thought at the time I was like, do I want to take a bath? Like what? And I kind of realized that the interviewer probably needed a bath. Do you know what I mean? Like she was bringing her anxiety over my busy life and imagining it and thinking to herself, like, I would just, you know, I take comfort in long baths. And I kind of was like, yeah, I don't, that's like me. I don't take comfort in long baths. I like my working life and being busy. And I take showers, like, you know, just like anybody. But more to the point, I was like, I could not imagine asking a male director if they needed a long bath. Yeah. I just thought, has that question ever been posed to a male leader? Do you know what I mean?
Can you imagine if, I'm just thinking about it now, can you imagine if a woman had directed The Revenant? You know that film that they shot in like Arctic temperatures for 9 months and Leonardo DiCaprio gets sort of, I mean,
ravaged by a bear.
You get shocked by a bear. But I wonder what they would have asked a woman to be like, do you need a hot water bottle? Like they never asked him, the director who was out there in sub-zero temperatures directing all these actors who are all like falling ill with pneumonia. They never really asked him much about his comfort or if he needed a long bath. And I bet he fucking did. If I'd directed that bloody movie.
Baths all the time, be in the hot tub every night.
There was there was no sort of like, are you okay? It was more like, well done.
It was a lot of well done. Yeah. Like, wow, you survived and you got this, you know, authenticity and da da da. Yeah. And it wasn't about like, how did you, you know, did you wear a down coat every day? Like, you know what I mean? I don't know.
What brand of down coat? How did Canada you match Goose. It to your lipstick, Elizabeth?
I know. How do you remain fashionable on the set of The Revenant?
Interestingly, I saw you talk about the fact that you wear dresses deliberately on set sometimes in order to make sure that you, I guess, because you're trying to make sure that the insinuation when you are taking a predominantly male role in that you are the director, you are the leader, and more often than not, we've seen men take on that role because of this systemic issue. But you don't want to try to emulate a man in the way that you dress or behave, because you think that it's very empowering and important for people to see that you can do it in a dress. You can do it as a woman in however your femininity plays out. Like it doesn't hinder or help the situation. It makes no difference. What is that? When did you start doing that?
So a couple things. One, I really think it's interesting to just represent a person of power on the set as being someone who can wear a dress. Mm-hmm. So, right. And pink and, you know, a headband, and, you know, whatever else I feel like wearing.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of a cone, you know, bra.
Well, there is a not every director wears sort of like the uniform, but I mean, there's, you know, you're standing up and walking around for 12 hours a day. So like, I'm not wearing high heels, particularly on sets, but my comfort in a, you know, in a dress is high. I have a high comfort level in a dress. So to me, that is also comfort in the way that you need in that job. But I also, I'll be totally honest, I had a camera, two women in my camera department, and the camera loader who's in the department came up to me on a project once and said, and they were in like, you know, their sort of the uniform for the camera department, just so everyone is clear, is typically some sort of cargo
pants, and
short
black t-shirt,
and a black t-shirt. Yeah. Okay. Jamila knows because she's been on sets. It's pretty
Crocs.
Standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, there's specific reasons for this. You need a lot of pockets in that job. You carry a lot of tools mm-hmm. with you at all times. And the black is because you don't want to reflect in camera and you want to sort of disappear, and black is the best color for that. There are reasons why people dress this way on set. But these women came up to me and said, "We love seeing you in a dress." They basically were like, we just love that you show up and you're wearing a dress. Like you don't have to do what we're doing right now, which is dress like all the guys. And I was just so happy to have heard that from them, and that I was offering them another idea about what the leader of the set looks like.
Yeah.
And that it was empowering to them to like see it. So
yeah.
And I just stuck with it.
And I know you're not trying to make some huge political statement in doing so, but I do think that there is a really important statement made about not trying to project the construct of what masculinity is, and masculinity therefore being the construct of what power and authority is. There are kind of like just unthought of layers. And I love the idea of the impact that that has, because I think when I look back on, and I've been very lucky to work with a lot of women directors, but there's definitely, and that may just be their choice, but there's definitely a presence that feels not just in aesthetic, but in sort of demeanor and delivery that feels different to when you then see them offset, and it feels more similar to the male directors than I would necessarily expect. But I don't mean that as a way of judgment. It's just something I noticed, and I realized I've never seen a director in a dress.
It's rare.
It is.
It's rare.
Yeah.
It is a rare thing.
Where do you continue to grow from? Like, are you just trying stuff out on set and trying new styles and trying new aesthetics? Are you going back and studying your old favorite films? Did you ever study under anyone, or did you just jump straight in? I just wonder that, because I only ask that because so many men I know have had the luxury of being given that opportunity to learn right under someone else, regardless of that person's gender.
I mean, I took every set as an opportunity to learn. So when I was coming up, you know, I went to what's called Video Village on sets. And I, you know, all this language that we're using is things that you and I understand. And I think it's always hard for listeners to get it, but the Video Village is where the director and typically the producer and the DP kind of gather while the scene is playing out. And if I wasn't in that scene, I always tried to be near them and sit in the Video Village and watch how things were playing out and ask questions. And I very gratefully, I worked with really interesting, awesome directors really early on. Like I worked with Steven Spielberg on Catch Me If You Can. And I worked with Sam Raimi on Spider-Man movies. And I remember being on the set of Spider-Man, and it was the DP on that film was Bill Pope, who shot Charlie's Angels with me. And he is how we met. And he and Sam Raimi were planning a shot of J. Jonah Jameson. I played Betty Brant in the three Spider-Mans that starred Tobey Maguire. Anyway, so I was on set and I was watching them plan out this shot. And in my mind, I was like, well, if I were doing this shot, I would start the camera here and I would put it on the dolly and I would back out and I would, you know, bring in more of the world and I would have people cross, da, da, da. And that was all in my brain. But then that's what they set up. They set up the shot that I thought would be the best way to tell that moment of that story. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, huh, okay, cool. Like, I mean, you know, maybe I know something, you know what I mean? Maybe I'm learning something here. And, you know, and I, by the way, I had directed plays and, you know, I studied theater and I have a master's of fine arts in, mm-hmm. you know, in acting. And so I worked on every level of kind of storytelling and studied the classics, you know, the Greeks and Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen. And, you know, so I bring some of that skill set with me to my career anyway. And then being on sets, you just learn, you know, you just sit there and just go, okay, wow, that's how they're doing this. That's how this is going to happen. And the other thing that I just love to say to people always is you don't need to know how to do everything to direct a movie. It's a collaboration. There's people that know about lighting. I don't know everything about lighting or, you know, stops on the camera. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not a camera operator. That's their job. There's a barrier that people think you have to, you know, you can't get through because you don't know the technical side of it. Don't wait, learn that on the job. You can learn that as you go. And if you work with the right partners in your department heads, so, you know, I don't sew costumes. The hell do I know? So it's why you bring people into the process with you. And when you find people that, when you have a vision for what you want and can communicate it, that's the most important thing to directing. It's not, you know, do you know what the stop is on this lighting setup? You know, you don't need to know all the technical stuff, the grips and the dollies and that they're there to support a vision. Having the vision is the most important thing.
100%. And it's so important, I think, for women in particular to hear that, because I think that there's like statistical evidence of the fact that we don't put ourselves up for jobs that we don't feel 1,000,000% qualified for. And yet statistically, men are much more likely to throw their hat in the ring for a job that they have absolutely no qualification for, just in the hopes of like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to back myself. I'll figure it out. I'll fake it till I make it. And I feel as though we are more held back by the imposter syndrome. And I talk about this a fair bit on this podcast, but I have never, no, and don't be like me, because I'm basically Catch Me If You Can, but I have never known how to do any of the things that I've gone on to do, any of them. And I'm figuring it out and I'm not always fucking perfect, but I've learned and I've grown and I've had, and when it's a fucking disaster, it's hilarious much later sometimes.
I do want to say the imposter syndrome, that's totally real. Fake it till you make it, totally real. The statistics that you're mentioning, totally real. Women have to be, typically need to be asked to like run for office, you know, like they don't just like walk in and go like, you know what, I deserve to be on the school board. You know, they need to be like, you know, talked into it. And same with directing and thing, you know, any of these sort of big leadership jobs, often women need to be asked, right? They don't put themselves up for the promotion. They hope somebody promotes them. But I will say that I also, the other side of that is that the stakes for women are higher. The consequences of not getting it right are higher mm-hmm. for women. I think there is a real fear that is rooted in our culture that if you do a bad job, that's it. That's your chance and you blew it. And so I want to recognize that for women too, like those stakes feel really high and I get it. I felt it too. I feel it. And I understand that it is a impediment to asking for more responsibility, more money, more resources to do things. Because when we mess up, you know, they don't let it go. You know, it's not some like,
they don't, but then at the same time, you and I have both had hits and misses in our careers and carried on, and the world didn't actually stop turning. And I think that's also really important. So yes, it is real that we will be shamed maybe a bit more for it. We will be judged harsher for it. And the standards are higher for us to meet at the very, very start. We give men more of an opportunity to learn, to be apprentices, to kind of, you know, work their way up slowly. And then we kind of sometimes panic, realize, oh no, we've not represented this minority or women, and so we're just going to throw one in quickly, like way in the deep end. And if she doesn't swim, if she sinks at all, then that was confirmation that we shouldn't have ever had a woman in that role, or a person with disability in that role, or a marginalized person of any kind. They use it as a kind of confirmation bias. And so what's so important is that you recognize that system, recognize the intention of that system, which is to make us believe that there's a good reason that we've all been excluded all this time.
That's right.
To chip away at our fucking self-confidence and realize that actually the best thing you can do is stick around. Stick around, carry on, learn
keep
from
going.
It, grow from it. Like just keep pushing. You are still directing, you are still acting, you have not had to win an Academy Award for every single thing you've done. You continue to grow, you continue to thrive, and you continue to excite all of us who are following your career with the decisions that you make. And it's really fun to watch you grow as a producer and as a director, and feel like we're all on that journey with you. And you know, if anyone has any doubts about what I'm saying, go back and watch the pilot of The Good Place and see what a pile of shit I am. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm having a panic attack the whole time I'm looking. I couldn't even look Kristen Bell in the eyes for 7 episodes. For the first 7 episodes, there were only 13 in the first season. And I couldn't look her in the eye. I would try to deliver all of my lines to William Jackson Harper that all were directed at Kristen Bell. I would have to say them to William Jackson Harper and quickly dart my eyes back at her because I felt so ashamed of being there because I had no idea of what I was doing. So go back and watch it. You can literally watch me grow and figure this shit out in real time.
Yeah. But you know what? Someone thought you belonged there and that you were right, and they were right.
Yeah.
And they gave you the opportunity, and then you, exactly what you're saying. And then you grew into that because someone else had the confidence that like, this is the right person for this job. And, and I, by the way, I'm grateful for everybody that's ever said, Liz Banks, let's let her try it. I think she can do it.
Yeah.
It is important. You do need those moments in your life, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, lucky for you, the first time you directed was Pitch Perfect 2. And the message for all young women out there is just keep going, try anyway, as you said. So Elizabeth Banks, before I lose you, will you tell me, what do you weigh?
Ooh, I weigh being a great mom, being a good daughter, being an artist, and I weigh my confidence that has grown over time. And I weigh my optimism about the future.
Love that. And love you. And see you soon if we find each other around the world. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. I Weigh with Jameela Jamil is produced and researched by myself, Jameela Jamil, Erin Finnegan, and Kimmy Gregory. It is edited by Andrew Carson, and the beautiful music you are hearing now is made by my boyfriend, James Blake. If you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show. It's a great way to show your support. We also have a bonus series exclusively on Stitcher Premium called Ask Jameela Anything. Check it out. You can get a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcher.com/premium and using the promo code IWEIGH. Lastly, over at IWEIGH, we would love to hear from you and share what you weigh at the end of this podcast. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-818-660-5543 or email us what you weigh at iweighpodcast@gmail.com. And now, we would love to pass the mic to one of our fabulous listeners.
I Weigh, a business owner, a rape and PTSD survivor, succeeding as a female wildlife camera operator, children's liver disease survivor, a good listener, lonely, sister, depressive, a National Geographic explorer, an activist, being 10 years into being probably James Blake's biggest fan. I'm hypermobile. I have a foam phobia, so this is very difficult. And I'm a charity fundraiser.